Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Jim Gould and your co-host today is Nixie Lamb. Good morning, Nixie.
Morning.
On this morning's programme, we're talking about, what else, but the Chief Executive's final policy address of her five-year term. Carrie Lam took more than 2 hours to deliver her last policy speech at the Legislative Council yesterday. The highlight was a plan for a massive 300-square-kilometre northern metropolis next to the border with the mainland. As expected, there were also proposals to restructure government bureaus and a commitment to strengthen national security further. What did you like or not like in Mrs. Lam's blueprint? You can let us know your thoughts. Leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. Email us at backchat@rthk.hk or give us a call on 233 88 266. Joining us this morning in our Admiralty studio, we have David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, and also on the line, John Burns, emeritus professor and honorary professor at the Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Hong Kong, and Dr. Rita Lee, director of Sustainable Real Estate Research Centre and associate professor at the Department of Economics and Finance at Hong Kong Shu Yan University. Thanks for joining to all our guests. Perhaps David Webb, if we could start with you. What's your overview of the policy address?
Well, in some ways it was manifesto for re-election because she won't have time to execute much of it at all. Most of the proposals are going to be in the new legislative year if they involve lawmaking, or 10 years down the road if they involve land reclamation, you know, for the Lantau metropolis or expanded science park and so on. There's far too much central planning in it. If you go through the document searching for buzzwords, IMT comes up 42 times. That means innovation and technology. One country, 31 times, national security, 29 times, metropolis, 30 times, and surprisingly, Lantau tomorrow, 3 times. It's been pushed way down the hype list because that was last year's buzz, and this year it's all about the northern metropolis. Oh, and a new word I hadn't come across, technopole, 3 times. There's some idea in her mind that simply by building, pouring more concrete, reclaiming more land, filling in fish ponds and so on, one can create an innovation and technology hub. And 150,000 people apparently are going to be employed in this. She knows this. I know not how, but she knows this. You know, this is unfortunately a bad way to run a territory. We should let market forces work. There's only one recognition, one appearance of the term market forces in the entire document, because the government knows best that we should all be doing INT, and that's in 42 times. Now, you know, you have to ask yourself whenever they start planning an even bigger science park, not having learnt from the first one and the Cyberport, and a humongous expansion, the Lok Ma Chau loop, we are now told, being only 87 hectares, which, by the way, is like twice the size of West Kowloon, we're told that's not big enough because across the river in Shenzhen, there is a 300-hectare earmarked area for INT. So we must be bigger. So we must grab some fish ponds nearby and expand and shift one of our port facilities across into the mainland territory and thereby expand the Lok Ma Chau loop even before it's been occupied by a single scientist. So, you know, when you divert government funds, which remember are taxpayers' funds, into these activities, you have to draw the money out of the economy to do it, and that's money that might have been allocated in other ways. The government never set aside land for an office park in Central, or a financial services park in Quarry Bay, for example, where the SFC is now based. These things happened organically on their own over decades, in the case of banking, of course, right back at the beginning of Hong Kong's settlement. So it's a shame that we're going down that road. On other areas, we've got another promise to fix the so-called MPF offset problem, which You know, I proposed a solution to over 5 years ago. It's very simple. When the MPF was introduced in 2000, and before that during the LegCo discussion, the government promised that employers would not have to pay twice. They were already paying long service payments to people who were retired. And so the government said, well, now we're going to have a more comprehensive scheme where we'll have the MPF, and you'll be able to offset the LSP obligation against money you've already put into the MPF fund for retirement, so that there wouldn't be a double call on the employers. And that's still the problem. And the solution was to freeze the LSP to stop paying long service accruals to any new employees. Of course, you wouldn't disturb the entitlements that people had built up to LSP. And then you could separate the two things, and the LSP would gradually fade away as people took new jobs without any entitlement to it. But instead, they want to carry on in parallel with both of these retirement schemes. And as a consequence, they want to spend 33 billion Hong Kong dollars of taxpayers' money subsidizing employers on some sort of declining basis, which is to compensate them for paying twice. Now, if it's on a declining basis, the logical thing for employers to do, and what I plan to do as an employer of one person, is to terminate my employee and immediately collect the subsidy while it's the highest level, and then re-employ her the next day. Because, you know, if they're going to play around like that, then so will I. But they really ought to just terminate the LSP system and recognize that we have a welfare system which could be improved for people who are unemployed, who are not yet at retirement age, and that's a separate issue.
Okay, well, several things there, but just sticking with the Northern Metropolis for now. Dr. Rita Lee, you're a real estate specialist and academic. What's your assessment of it?
Well, I would put it this way. That is the main point about the development of the northern part of New Territories, which is actually the focus of Carrie Lam's proposal. Actually, the whole proposal in that part, that it tried to deal with the long-term housing problems or long-term housing issues, where, like, for example, five railways will be constructed stations there, and then providing housing projects about like 650,000 work positions, and then it will also provide the 920,000 of the housing units, which can allow occupants of 2.5 million. So this actually can eventually lead to a long-term provision of the sufficient number of the housing units for the long-term goal. And then to a certain extent, I think that this is a way for which we can deal with the problem, which has been last for long, which includes like, those extremely small size of flats, and then the housing problem that is mentioned by earlier this this morning, the phone-in members who tried to call upon Carrie Lam about like there is no sufficient housing units, private housing, etc. And then one more thing that is the co-development of the New Territories Park, that they also relaxed the sale restriction of the Chow Tong land amendment to the New Territories ordinance. Yeah. Even though that we all know that Section 15 of the New Territory Ordinance of the Cap 97 does not really specify, like, for example, what is the black hole of the sale of the Chow Tong lands or the government's procedure on handling the application of consent of such sale. But the judge, court judgment in the past is that there is a unanimity is required for the Chow Tong to sell to Chow Tong lands. So therefore, actually, the district officers themselves, they have to ensure that the unanimous consent came from all members when handling these applications. So that actually become a main hurdle all over the time that if there's like we have got 20% that they disagree, we cannot do anything. So say, for instance, if we try to lessen to like 80%, even though that the policy address has not stated that, then the whole process can be done in a lot faster way. And it can release the land much more in the short one, I would just say. And then so this is a way for sure. I think in the new torturous part that they have that she has done a lot of a great job, and then providing the job opportunities so that people do not need to rush to the Hong Kong Island side. And then so I think the new torturous part has done a great job there. And then for the for other parts, like for example the existing one, because the estates like housing estates owned by those like the government, like for example Hong Kong Housing Authority and the criticized government departments like Hong Kong Housing Society, that is a much more faster way in terms of like redevelopment, because you do not need to deal with like multi ownership problems, etc. So redevelopment of the Tai Han estate, for example, it has been identified as providing 3,300 units, which ultimately agree. And then the two estates, there's a Sai Wan estate and also Mata Wai estates, 260 years old estate, obviously that it should be like obsolete. So it should have been tried to redevelop it for long, and then so that environmental degradation can be minimized, and then improve the existing transportation and also other facilities.
Okay.
And then so that I think it's just a good way to do it.
It is very aspirational, though, when you look at the numbers involved thrown into this. First of all, 920,000 units. That includes 390,000 existing homes in places like Yuen Long and Tin Shui Wai.
Yeah, Fanling.
And so you're talking at 530,000 units net. But even so, if you assume two people per unit, that's 1.06 million people that they're expecting to house. And we've only got about 100,000 households in subdivided units. And obviously, some of those could stay if they cease to be subdivided, they'd still provide some units. So where are all these people coming from? We've had a population drop of about 100,000 in the last year. There's a brain drain going on. And if you simply build excessive amounts of housing, there'll be excessive vacancies, and then prices would tend to fall. So, I think in practice, this paper is aspirational. It's a manifesto, and a lot of it is NGTH, not going to happen. It is a fair description of some of the plans that were already underway in the new territories. There were already plans for
put it the other way around, because like look at the case of like Cheung Kwan Old NCR station. So if you try to look at like Lowhurst Park and also many other stations in the Cheung Kwan Old line, then we actually know that by the time that the railway is built, there are a lot of the housing estates could be built together as well, because actually the transportation is one of the main concerns by the time that we decide to like build or not to build, and then whether or not the people will really move.
But Rita, people can't live in more than one home at the same time, and they could if they had a holiday home in the new territories, but that's not the plan, is it? There's a supplemental paper that came out about this northern metropolis. There's a whole big colourful brochure on it, and it mentions a huge influx of young people. Well, the last group of young people I saw was at the airport heading outwards.
You're right. Actually, because of the fact that we have got 120,000 people over that have already been gone, but then still that we have got a lot of people who are still waiting on the list.
So where is this huge influx of young people coming from? I mean, this is the question. Are we simply going to spread out the existing public housing households and give a unit to every young person who becomes 18 years old?
I would just say that because we have got quite a large demand now, so that the housing price is still going up. So it just implies that even if that we just talk about like just in an existing position, then we still have got a very large demand.
Yeah. Part of the problem is that the government is very bad at allocating the public housing stock that it's got. What happens is, first of all, you don't get means tested after the age of 60. You're only paying 10% of median income as rent. And when your children grow up and leave home, you don't have to move out. So you enjoy that perk and have spare bedrooms on your hands. And so over the last decade or so, they've built about...
Previously, I have also done research on about like moving out. But the question is that if your house is very big, you actually don't want to like squeeze yourself into a very small home, right? Because in Hong Kong, if we talk about the home size, like three bedroom. It is a large. It is a. We just say that it is not a small room at least. But if we talk about like the places like in Australia, for example, a lot of us that we have got like for example 2-story high, and then so that actually the size is like a lot of the housing are very very small.
So different
one,
issue.
To one extreme case, for example, one of my friends who is a judge for the court, and then for her first home that she buy, there's a flat without a bedroom, you know. So that it is like
studio?
I would just say that even you can imagine that the young judge also buy this kind of home. So what does that mean? So it means that home size is very small. So after all, the lot in part itself that they have got a. They have got a demand over
right,
there.
Right, but are you saying that...
Nick,
are you
is,
saying
about,
that
Nick is about to jump in. We also have John Burns on the line. But just before we bring in John Burns, sorry, bear with me, because there's a very relevant email here from Eric. Says, I'm wildly perplexed. Exactly a year ago, Mrs. Lamb's policy address extolled that the East Lantau metropolis was the single perfect place for Hong Kong to create a large 1,000-hectare development area. 12 months later, Mrs. Lamb is saying that the optimum location for a large development is the North New Territories, Northern Metropolis. I will be interested to know how both can be optimum. Also, with an ageing population, zero Hong Kong population growth at government's own figures, and only 150 return permit holders per day, comprising the single component of increase in population, who is going to live in these two metropolises? Finally, government simply does not have enough government civil servant manpower to develop ELM, let alone the Northern Metropolis. That from Eric. John Burns, what's your view?
Well, I've been listening to what others have said. I agree that the policy address is aspirational, and it does address some of these problems like housing and integration of Hong Kong with the GBA to a certain extent, which, by the way, has been around since 2015. But to me, this policy address is the sort of thing that we would expect to see at the beginning of a CE's term. Where has she been for the last 5 years is what I would like to know. And, you know, she only understands the urgency of these issues after being kicked, it would appear to me. And now that we have aligned LegCo and the executive, and we can expect LegCo to support this plan, so then performance of it or on it depends on the policy capacity of the government. And this, you know, isn't just analytical capacity, and David Webb has faulted that, and I take that's important, and operational capacity, but it also depends on political capacity. And this is accountability, trust, and participation, these sorts of things. There's no evidence that the government understands this at all. And then the final thing I would say about this is many of these solutions are the tired old thinking of, you know, the way the government has proposed things in the past. Now, unlike David Webb, you know, I'm more critical of the market and neoliberalism. And so we cannot expect Hong Kong to simply grow itself out of inequality and stunted social mobility, which is the situation that we have now. These issues were not addressed at all.
Nixie, you kind of...
No, I'm just thinking, yeah. like because David was mentioning about like letting the market to run on organically, which I think a lot of people in Hong Kong are still suffering from, like the housing problems. It's kind of a big issue.
That is not organic. The housing system is run very badly by the government. 50% of people live in either rental housing or subsidized purchase housing.
But just thinking At this point, having a more visionary plans will be something that we'll really need. Not really sure how the implementation is actually
doing. I've certainly written about some of these solutions. One thing, again, for the allocation of public rental housing, in order to stop people squatting on three-bedroom units with only one person in them or two people in them, you know, a couple after the kids leave home and they start using the spare rooms as, you know, I don't know what, but instead give everybody a voucher equal to the full market value of their of the unit that they're in, but based on the number of people living in that unit, so that when the household shrinks, the voucher shrinks, and they must either subsidise it themselves or move to a smaller public rental unit. And then you don't, if you bring those prices up to market levels with the vouchers in hand, people would be much more mobile. You could sell off the public rental housing estates into real estate investment trusts, and people who lose their security guard job in Tinshoi Wai and get one in Aberdeen can move to Aberdeen and take their PR, their voucher with them and rent a unit there in the free market with the full market value of the unit that they would occupy. So, you know, that there are market-based solutions. In the UK, the government moved away in the 1990s and 1980s from council housing. They recognised that making poor people live in ghettos, all the poor people living together with no middle-class people, was not a good idea. And instead, they moved it towards subsidising people's rents if they needed help, which is the right thing to do. And so the council housing stock was basically privatised. We should be looking at that solution to get a more efficient use of the units we're building, because the last 200,000 units that were built by the housing authority only increased the population of the housing, the public rental housing, by 200,000 people, because people are just spreading out. So that's one thing. And if you basically gave up on the government being both the landlord and the social welfare provider, and instead said the government must provide the social welfare, they must provide a rental voucher, but they won't be the landlord, then you remove a lot of the tension from the system about whether we, you know, how many bits of land should be allocated to public versus private housing, for example. It just becomes all privately owned, but subsidised to the tenant.
Okay. Rita Lee, because I know you're only with us until 9 o'clock, but what about that point that Eric made about we now have two major development areas, the Northern Metropolis and the East Lantau Metropolis, or the Lantau Tomorrow Vision, or as Mrs. Lam was referring to it in her speech yesterday on a number of occasions, the Gao Yi Chao Artificial Islands. I mean, do we need both mega projects, and you know, will there be enough people to fill them?
I think we have a housing problem that is, like, for example, the people that live in an extremely small house problem. Even if we talk about, like, if the population does not grow that much, but then we still have got a lot of the problem, like, for example, the extremely small size of the housing units, even if we, like, for example, we can try to use other methods, like, for example, downsizing. But I can tell you that in most of the circumstances, the old people, if we try to, like, move them from a big house to a small house, they will feel sort of, like, very suffer and losing face. You know, in Chinese, we always say that this is, like, a kind of, like, lose face activity. It's like, move from a big house to
a small house.
Well,
then we have to educate them that that is not a social stigma. I mean, yeah. People do downsize.
I think it's like this Singaporean approach, like they just, like, depending on how many people is actually in that household, you have to move.
Yeah, the HDB system gets reallocated.
Actually, another thing is that if you move them to a housing estate that is not the housing estate that they're familiar with, there is also another problem that is, like, all
like
people
the social
that
circle.
Stick to that committed community that they stick with.
Right, so there are enough.
If they move to a new housing estate, yeah, which they are not familiar with, a lot of them, they worry that they will pass away.
Well, Rita, there are thousands of units in each estate, right? They're not all the same size. There are one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom units in each estate, maybe even four-bedroom units.
You have got a lot of friends and relatives, and then you always bring them to your home, and then all of a sudden they find that your home is getting smaller.
Give them the new address.
We've got to break for the news at 9 o'clock. Sorry, we have to break for the news at 9. Thanks very much for joining us, Rita Lee, Director of Sustainable Real Estate Research Centre at Shuyan University. A quick look at the weather. Mainly cloudy with a few showers. The outlook, windy with occasional heavy squally showers tomorrow and over the weekend. Currently it's 30 degrees, humidity 66%. The strong monsoon signal is in effect.
Hey.
And welcome back to Backchat with Nixie Lamb and me, Jim Gould. And this morning we're talking about the Chief Executive's policy address, the last of her current five-year term. Just before we resume chat with our guests, a few emails here. David writes, obviously a lot of people are planning to be imported to work here, which will consume a lot of property because they will need to live here. So population was expected around 8.5 million. If it goes up to 10 million, we're going. Where are we going to get all the water from? Because I thought China didn't have enough supply for Hong Kong and China. The government is already turning villages into squatter areas by overcrowding. So this is decreasing our quality of life and creating more respiratory problems. And public health service is well undermanned. And if the government was to employ 500 lawyers, they could reduce the refugees in Hong Kong. And many of us live in the new territories, and there is not enough transport now. From David. John writes, Dear Backchat, the CE's policy address failed to provide any visibility on when Hong Kong's borders, both with China and the rest of the world, will be opened, and or when our tough quarantine rules can be relaxed. The public has been continuously asking for the government to provide us with a roadmap to normalisation. For example, will travel restrictions be relaxed if we reach 80% vaccination rate? But her two-hour speech, disappointingly, didn't address this issue. Hong Kong, together with China, Macau and Taiwan, are the only remaining places in the world that are still adopting a zero-COVID policy. It is high time for us to abandon this approach. Some commentators have suggested that Beijing won't change course until after the Winter Olympics in late February. In an interview with Bloomberg yesterday, Frederick Golub, chairman of the European Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong, said that a number of European companies are considering relocating some staff from Hong Kong to Singapore directly because of Hong Kong's zero COVID policy and its restrictive effects. John writes, okay, same John, actually. I was surprised that the CE didn't announce a proposed redevelopment of the Kwai Chung container port and concurrent relocation of the existing facilities to Tuen Mun, as had been rumoured over the past week. This seems a lost opportunity to produce tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of apartments in the urban area, while also generating billions of dollars of much-needed revenues for the government in the form of land premium. And Vic writes, Dear Backchat, wish the policy address had something in relation to income redistribution. Each crisis of the past, maybe the financial crisis, SARS, riots or pandemic, the rich have found ways to increase their wealth by exploiting the underprivileged. When and where will we find a solution to that? Government of the rich, by the rich, for the rich. That's from Vic. Well, we talked a lot before the break about the proposed new northern metropolis up near the border. Of course, there was a lot of other things in the policy address, including a shake-up of government bureaus. Perhaps John Burns, Emeritus Professor at the Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Hong Kong. Also with us is David Webb, founder and editor of Website. And we're joined on the line, I believe, also by Terence Lau, Executive Vice President of Avalon Biomedical Management Limited. John Burns, perhaps if we could talk a little bit about the reorganization of the government bureaus. Do you think that a good idea?
You know, we have tried this many times before, and all we are really doing is rearranging the silos if we don't do more than what was talked about in the policy address. And so this, as I said before, policy capacity, I think, is very important. And we have faulted the government's analytical capacity. But, you know, I think in order to make however the government is reorganized more effective, we need to address the trust deficit in Hong Kong. We need to address the lack of accountability locally in Hong Kong, and we need to address the participation problem, civic engagement or something like that. And none of that is being proposed in this policy address, simply rearranging the bureaus. I'm not very optimistic that this will prove to be more effective.
Yeah, the problem there is that you don't solve the problem that the bureaus don't cooperate with each other very well. All you're trying to do is reduce the overlap between them so that you don't have to cooperate too much with each other by minimizing the interplay. But you can only do so much of that, and you need to have better mechanisms of cooperation and better incentives to cooperate. I mean, why is it that civil servants can't be on some element of performance-linked pay which benchmarks them against targets met, which incentivizes them to work with each other when the projects involve more than one bureau? That would be one way to do it. Otherwise, what's in it for them? Because otherwise they keep their head down, and the easiest answer to everything is no, because they can only get into trouble for doing something new.
But this only focuses on the government. I mean, what I'm talking about is government and civil society,
right,
and the relationship between the state and civil society.
Well, as you know, John, that has been dramatically reduced. I mean, because you can't choose your representatives unless they pass through the filter.
They still have to do something, right?
They have to pass through the Eligibility Review Committee, and the district councils have basically got so small now that the government is even withdrawing projects from them and saying, well, we'll decide because your councils are now down to a few people, and that's not enough.
But listen to the people that are listening to this show. They talked about water, environmental sustainability, COVID, all of these things. They're co-produced with the people. And yet, you know, this part of it, this state society part of it, is being completely ignored. Mm. So you rearrange the deck chairs, you pay the civil servants, you know, incentive pay or whatever it is, but even this is not going to solve the problem unless you address the state-society link. And the government is simply retreating from society. I think this is a huge mistake.
Hmm. Okay, Terence Lau of Avalon Biomedical, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Yeah,
morning.
Hi. So what was in this policy address for you?
Well, I think I'm from the innovation technology areas. I think the government has put in a lot more resources to continuous, you know, supporting the development of innovation and technology. And it's good for us, you know, either for academia in university and also for industry working in this area.
Mm. What about the restructures of the bureau? I mean, the current bureau is the Innovation and Technology Bureau, and it says it's going to become adding on the industrial side as well. So what is that for you?
I think they see the problems that we've been doing in the past years, because we were wishfully thinking we can translate our invention discoveries to somewhere like Shenzhen or places around, and we just do basic research, do the invention, and we can get the return by commercializing, you know, our invention somewhere else. But it's not going to be work out, you know, because, you know, one of the most important things to realize the commercial values of basic research result is to translate, you know, those inventions into real applications.
Mm-hmm.
But if the industry is, you know, happening somewhere else, all those activities will be around the industry. So we need to have our own industry if we really want to realize the values that are coming out from the basic research. So I think it's a very strategic move, and we need to rebuild our industry in order to, you know, close the loop and build our own ecosystem to sustain, you know, long-term economy development from innovation technology.
Should we close the loop, or should we use the cheaper land and labor that's available across the border for exploiting inventions? I mean, why should the government take land that could be used for better purposes, more productive purposes, and allocate it to factories, for example, which is what we're talking about here, really, when you say reindustrialization, and then subsidize people to employ to be employed in those factories?
Yeah, but we are talking about advanced, you know, innovation and technology, talking about advanced manufacturing. Mm. It's not very, similar to those, you know, we were in...
not labor-intensive ones.
Not labor-intensive. We need high-skilled people. We need to generate value. So I understand that all people need, people from all sectors need lands, but we need to think about how to divide those lands into different areas in order to generate, you know, the support for the whole economies in Hong Kong.
China is extremely good, and so are other regional countries.
It's a cooperation in between.
Yes, there are synergies in having the mainland produce the smartphones and Hong Kong work on designing smartphones, for example. Why would we need to be throwing taxpayers' money at subsidizing the manufacture of them by giving them cheap land? Isn't that a poor use of public resources?
That would be the different stages, you know, of industry, because, you know, talk about the very, very downstream manufacturing is the end of the invention. So even those, you know, Apple's at the first place, they do not start, you know, translating process in mainland or other places where they need a lot of people. Mm. They have to do all those translational development, industry development at their places, you know, close to their, research origins. I think in some days that we may be able to do that, but not now, because we need to sustain our, you know, research and innovation loop. Otherwise, all the invention will be gone, all the translational processes will be gone, all the talent will be gone, and we may not be able to attract enough talent to help building the process. And, you know, I don't see if you have a factory, the translating process in for example, Shenzhen, or somewhere in China, those people will back to Hong Kong because they may be coming from some other countries. They are not originally from Hong Kong. So we were just losing out all these, you know, early
international talents
to other places.
Well, maybe that's just not what we're good at. I mean, you know, there's nobody says that we have to have a Silicon Valley in Hong Kong. And if the government tries to push us in that direction, then it's just going to be wasting public money. Why not just let Hong Kong be good at what it's good at, which is most of all the interconnector? And this is a government phrase I'm borrowing here. We are the interconnector between the mainland and the world, financially, in financial services, in trade and design sometimes as well. But we sit in between. Why should we force the economy into biotechnology or something else?
Side as well, if you look at the,
well, if we're good, then fine. If people have a good idea, one's stopping them.
My question is for Terence. I have to jump in, David, please. My question is, what sort of innovation side we're actually good at? I noticed that when we land on Mars, like, we have some technologies actually from the polytechnic universities and stuff. And a lot of people, we don't really understand what side of the innovation is like quite advanced in Hong Kong. I mean, of course, a lot of the government higher officials, they understand, but it seems like the whole Hong Kong society doesn't really know about it. Can you actually explain a bit on that?
Responding to what David just mentioned, we're not, doing one side or the other. We just need to think about how we capture some of the opportunity. We need to think about what positioning that we want to be in, what would be the ultimate goal for developing all this innovation technology. We want to have, it to be one of the engines for Hong Kong's economy. So we're not trying to do something that we just want to do, but we really want to build in Hong Kong, diversify our economies into somewhere else. And to, the questions are just asked, we are not doing all innovation technology. Of course, landing on Mars is very fascinating, but it's a university, basic research project. is for, you know, from the curiosity of the university professors and also the real needs from somewhere else, from our mainland government. Mm. But for Hong Kong, we need to pick something that fits into our economy. We need something that we do not need a lot of labors. We have a build our advanced skills. That's just like, you know, think about TSMC.
Mm.
They do not have a lot of, you know, operation in Taiwan, but they're supporting Taiwan very huge in terms of economies.
Mm.
They are just, you know, some factories in Hsinchu and that.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, they build their know-how, their skill sets that can sustain the growth of Taiwan economies, you know, to a certain extent. So I think this is one of the ways that we may need to think about, to pick the industry that we could really help Hong Kong to diversify our economy, now mostly based on land and financial, but we need to have something else to support our, you know, future growth.
Do we have enough scientific talents at the moment, do you think?
We have a lot of good university basic researchers, but we need to attract more on translational process, you know. I mean, working on translational research, because they are not, you know, these experts are not from university. We need to attract them to come to Hong Kong.
How do we attract bright young people from foreign universities, for example, to come to Hong Kong when, first of all, for the time being, they can't, basically, without a 21-day quarantine? And secondly, even if they come, they can't buy a home for 7 years, because otherwise they have to pay a ridiculously high stamp duty as a non-permanent resident, 23.5% stamp duty to buy a home. And then, of course, there's the international image of Hong Kong after the national security law took effect, and the reduction of democracy or pseudo-democracy. We're now down to a very narrow franchise.
Democracy and how does that, scientific research.
Well, how does that attract a liberally minded scientist to come and work here? Or are you hoping that basically that they'll all come from the mainland?
I agree there are a lot of challenges.
There's challenges for everything.
She did say, the chief executive did say yesterday, she pointed to the very large number of international firms doing business here, and as evidence that the business environment had improved. I mean, national security was a very strong theme of the policy address. It kind of ran throughout. She said the introduction of the NSL and the overhaul of the electoral system had meant that we were now in a new era where the society was peaceful again, things could get done. LegCo could operate properly. John Burns, she also said that the obligation to enact the Article 23 National Security Law, as set out in the Basic Law, she regretted that it hadn't happened in the past under previous chief executives, but sounds like it's not going to happen under her either, because there's not enough time before the end of this current term, unless, of course, she does another one. What do you think?
Listen, on things like national security and these sorts of things, they could pass it in 3 days. So I don't underestimate the ability of the central government on security issues or anything like that. So, but we're in a very unfortunate place, it seems to me, simply because for this entire exercise, policy address exercise, we have only been focusing on the government and what the government is going to do and what the government is trying to do. And we are not taking into consideration the people of Hong Kong who live here and on whom the government needs, the government depends on these people, us, for support. And with trust levels so low and restricted participation and all the other things that the catalog of things that have been listed on this program already, this indicates that the thinking, the way the government is approaching this is too narrow and is too restricted. I don't think this is the way to go, personally. You know, I've talked about accountability repeatedly, and I think it's fair to say that if Carrie Lam had been a mayor of a mainland city and she'd brought that city to their knees as she did in Hong Kong in 2019, she would have been long gone. We wouldn't be talking about this from this perspective at all.
Is it entirely fair to blame her for bringing the city to its knees in 2019?
Well, who proposed the extradition bill?
Well, exactly.
I'm just putting it out there for discussion.
I mean, I'll just leave it at that. You don't need to go much further other than to understand the chain of consequences.
I totally agree with you, David.
You know, on the quarantine issue and the sort of every effort being taken to bring Hong Kong into the mainland bubble of quarantine, they basically want to remove the barrier and allow people to travel freely with to and fro to the mainland. The alternative, of course, is for us to stay on the outside and open up. And I think that the greatest contribution Hong Kong could make at this point to the motherland and to the one country is to be separate in our system and open up not just to international capital movements, as we always have, and a free port for goods, as we always have been, but also to the free movement of people again, so that until China is ready to open its own borders, we would actually take one for the country, as it were, by opening up, allowing some infections in, driving up the vaccination rate, adopting approach more in line with other developed economies, which are now opening up, rather than being left behind as places like Singapore move ahead, because otherwise we are facing a real situation of banks reallocating some of their staff to Singapore, for example, so that their families can visit freely, relatives can come and see their grandchildren and children in Singapore, but can't do that in Hong Kong. I mean, I've had to sit here in Hong Kong and watch my father's funeral online. I haven't been away for nearly 2 years. I've dispatched my eldest son to university with the expectation that he won't be able to come back at least until next summer. And this is just an example of the way our approach has disrupted ordinary life in Hong Kong. But I think we could adopt a different line rather than trying to get into the China bubble, but stay on the outside and resume traffic and trade fairs and exhibitions and sporting events and conferences and so on, all of the things that go with that, in return for accepting that there will be a small number of cases, mostly amongst people who've refused to take the vaccine.
John?
I do not think that this is something that the Hong Kong government can do politically. I think they've been told what they have to do, and they are trying to do it. You only have to listen to John Lee. So there isn't the discretion to do what you propose, although...
Well, I'm just suggesting that they should think about educating the mainland into this idea that the better contribution that Hong Kong could make to the one country would be to be the only place on Chinese soil with free movement of people.
The only people that represent Hong Kong at the center where it matters are people like Lo Hui Ning. Is he going to argue for Hong Kong on this issue?
Well, we'd have to
I don't think so.
We'll have to see.
I don't think so. So, you know, I mean, if you look at the central government, the people that matter are not from the Hong Kong government.
I think people who expect China to open up right after the Olympics are being hopelessly optimistic. With the current situation in the mainland, having basically brought the entire country to believe that Xi Jinping has led them to the sunlit uplands of zero infections, and that dual circulation is much more important, you know, in terms of people spending their money at home, and not wishing to expose the population by travelling to overseas ideologies and influences, that it rather suits them to stay hunkered down as long as possible. And so, you know, if we move into that bubble, we can expect Hong Kong to be locked into the quarantine for possibly years to come.
Okay, thanks for paraphrasing Winston Churchill there. Terence Lau, is there any concern in your sector about the zero COVID policy? Is it affecting your business?
Oh, definitely, you know, we can go, you know, places, you know, outside Hong Kong, not just mainland, but also other countries, because, you know, when we come back, we need to be quarantined. So, yeah, it's not affects very much. You know, just like myself, I have a factory in Shenzhen, you know, for COVID diagnostic, but I haven't been there since it started last year. So it's really a huge problem.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well. Look, thanks very much for joining us, everybody. We'll have to call it a day because we're almost out of time. But thank you very much to Terence Lau, Executive Vice President of Avalon Biomedical Management Limited. Thank you very much to David Webb, founder and editor of Website. And thanks very much to John Burns, Emeritus Professor and Honorary Professor at the Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Hong Kong. Thanks very much to you, Nixie. See you next time. And thanks to before 9 o'clock, we heard from Rita Lee, Director of Sustainable Real Estate Research Centre and Associate Professor at the Department of Economics and Finance at Hong Kong Shu Yan University. Just a few more emails from listeners. So Paul Zimmerman writes, the northern metropolis is a good step away from the Lantau metropolis. Cleaning up the existing land of the new territories versus creating new land has been promoted by many as the appropriate, cost-effective way forward for Hong Kong. It focuses government resources in addressing the abusive and wasteful land situation in the new territories. Simon writes, dear Backchat, David has questioned where will the people come from to occupy the northern metropolis. The answer is from the mainland. It will serve both as a colonisation mechanism to increase loyal mainland Chinese in Hong Kong, as well as providing cheaper accommodation than Shenzhen. Anyone living in Shenzhen will attest to the high price of Shenzhen property. This from Colin says, I'm all for planning and with a vision. Looking at demographics in China and Hong Kong, the long-term forecast is for declining and ageing populations. Where are these people coming from? Where does Lantau tomorrow and these proposals fit in together? That's from Colin. I think that's all. Let me see. Okay. Any other emails? Haven't had time to read out. We'll try and deal with them at a later time. A quick look at the weather before we go to the news summary and morning brew. Mainly cloudy with a few showers. Sunny intervals during the day. Top temperature around 31 degrees. Fresh east to northeasterly winds. Strong offshore. The outlook, it will be windy with occasional heavy squally showers tomorrow and during the weekend. There will be swells. The weather will improve and it will be dry early next week. It's currently 30 degrees, humidity 65%, and the strong monsoon signal is in effect.